Our first speaker today is Dr. Kim Anderson. Kim Anderson is a professor in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology at Oregon State University. Dr. Anderson is conducting research to assess the fate and bioavailability of PAHs in air, sediments, and overlying waters within Superfund contaminated urban and undeveloped field sites. To accomplish this, she is developing biological response indicator devices, passive samplers that are capable of connecting an environmental exposure to a biological response or effect. Dr. Anderson, the phone line is yours.
Well, thank you, Chuck. And I want to also thank Patrick and Jean for hustling around here this morning. I'm sure that got everyone's adrenaline going when the alternate plans had to be made, and I hope everyone is able to get on that wants to be accessed on the presentations. And again, thank you, Chuck, for the introduction. So I'm on slide 3, if anyone is working their way through. And as Chuck mentioned, what we're looking at are passive sampling devices, which we've named Bridges, in an attempt to connect all that with a biological response. So on the next slide, I have the question, why bioavailable? And probably if you're on this webinar, that's you already know the answer, but nonetheless, to introduce the concept of why we care, is trying to understand, of course, estimating exposure dose, or in our case, exposure concentration from an environmental standpoint. And so we have plenty of information in the literature that looks at The literature certainly has many instances where what we measure in the environment is not really linked to what is expressed in any kind of exposure scenario. And so there's very simple examples of that from lead or mercury, which we'll talk about later today. And so understanding that speciation or bioavailability is certainly important for understanding toxicity. But it's also important for understanding environmental fate. So if we understand how chemicals move in the environment, understanding their speciation clearly links to how they move in the environment. If they are speciating something that's more mobile or less mobile, certainly important to understand how all that wraps around both environmental fate and exposure. And then, of course, ultimately understanding environmental factors on disease and how do we make tools that connect what's in the environment to exposure scenarios are important. And so that's what just a few reasons why we're interested in bioavailability and why we're interested in that. And I just put up on the next slide one example from a real-world concentration, and I, in this case, just used a classic pesticide, chlordane. And if you actually look up in the Merck index, you'll see that the water solubility is 56 parts per billion. And what's interesting is if you then dig a little deeper, you'll find that the LC50 for rainbow trout is 90 parts per billion. And one might scratch their head, well, how did that happen? If the water solubility is 56, of course, there's always the question how the studies were done. But beyond, and that's always an issue. Sometimes chemists find people exceeding the solubilities with their exposures. But in this particular case, they were, of course, able to get those solubilities because it wasn't just pure water. And that's something that I always talk to my students about is when they give these solubilities, for instance, in the Merck index, it's a pure water. No other components, and that hardly represents a river or an ocean system. So, in fact, as you can see, I usually have this come in at a later point for drama, but as you can see, the chlordane solubility, when you have just simply 34 milligrams per liter of dissolved organic carbon, you can see what that does to the solubility of chlordane, obviously increases it tremendously. Now, does that mean it's more bioavailable? Maybe not, because it's clearly probably absorbed in part to that dissolved organic carbon. However, it certainly affects the fate if it's in the water phase versus in the sediment phase. And so these are the kinds of things that one's certainly interested in when they're looking at bioavailability. What is the bioavailability in real systems? And certainly one can't just guesstimate this from for instance, water solubility. So if we move on to the next slide, you can see where bioavailability trying to tie in environmental chemistry and toxicology is kind of where bioavailability sits. And so trying to develop methods, environmental concentrations, trying to understand fate relative to a certain fraction that's bioavailable, and then trying to link that to the toxicology, whether it's toxicokinetics or toxicodynamics, how do those species in a real system link between those two, environmental chemistry and toxicology? That's a little bit where we wanted to go with developing our bioanalytical tool, Bridges. So on the next slide, you can see that I've adapted this from Schwartz, and the top part is really kind of where we want to go with the passive sampling device and our biological endpoint. So in part of the development of the technology, it was important also to validate the technology. So a lot of times there's been, yeah, you can do this, but it actually hasn't been linked to an actual bioassay. It's been proposed or maybe in small scale demonstrated. So we wanted to try to, with the Bridges project, take a contaminant exposure from the environment and try to link that contaminant exposure to a toxic response. And we hope to do the contaminant exposure from the environment with the passive sampling device, which is the development of these bioanalytical tools. And we hope to take that environmental contaminant exposure as sampled from the passive sampling devices and then link that to a toxic response. And in the model system that we're using, it's a zebrafish developmental model system. And then finally, to validate all that, which is what we'll talk about in a few moments, trying to essentially reduce that uncertainty of what is the environmental exposure and what is the biological response. So if we go to the next slide, the idea of the Bridges is to really get beyond sort of the one time or one analyte or maybe one class of analytes and to look at an entire mixture of analytes, either as an exposure concentration or an exposure dose. So we're looking at mixtures and trying to understand both the fate of those large mixtures in a biological response. One of the things from the environmental side that's important also is for us not to lump all the bioavailable processes. So while the passive sampling device is in water or air, and initially I'll talk more about water, is to in fact, in the case of fish, for example, to mimic what's available in the water portion that's bioavailable. So the first step is in an aquatic food chain is the uptake of the dissolved bioavailable fraction to an organism. And that process has been understood to be the most important process up the food chain. It does not simulate at this point, of course, if the food consumption. So that's another component that is separate. But to if you start lumping too many processes together, it gets rather hard to unravel all of that. So we think that that's important that, in fact, it is a specific process, the bioavailable in the aquatic system. Another component that's very important that we're trying to address is the integration of space and time into a health risk framework. And what I mean by that is even in small geographic regions, there can be a tremendous difference in the concentration of various contaminants. And that can sometimes be difficult to discern if you don't have an inexpensive tool in which to essentially sample or monitor at those sites. And I'll give examples of those in a few minutes. In addition, looking at time, we see a tremendous difference in the in contaminated areas on a seasonal basis and sometimes even on a daily basis. So on a seasonal basis, we see quite a bit of difference in the contaminant load that's presented. So again, if you have an inexpensive technique or a technique that's doing time integration over a specific time frame that is important to the question or fit for the purpose, then those tools have value beyond taking a simple grab sample at 8 o'clock in the morning. So if you move to the next slide, is a cartoon of a cell membrane. And in that visual picture is sort of a bulk solution, and there's both, as you can see, lipophilic nature of the cell and also pore sizes. So this is, of course, this is the system we're trying to model or to essentially develop a surrogate for a cell membrane rather than using organisms. And in doing that, if you move to the next slide, you'll see some of the specific characteristics that have been specifically targeted with the development of passive sampling devices. And those are twofold. One is a chemical goal, which is to have the cell membranes clearly have a very lipophilic character, and so trying to develop passive sampling devices that also have lipophilic character. And also the pore size. And the pore size has been estimated on these types of on these cells to be nominally 9.5 angstroms, and so again developing passive sampling devices that mimic that. In the case of the one that we use is a polyethylene membrane polymer, which has a lot of lipophilic character clearly, and in various scanning electron microscopes, the estimated pore size is nominally 10 angstroms. So in this way, this particular device, as well as others, mimic both that lipophilic membrane character and the physical pore size attributes of a membrane. And so, and there are other types of passive sampling devices, and I've listed a few of those on the right side of the slide. As you can see, various types of polymer material have been used, and we're actually using other things besides the polyethylene that I'm going to be talking about today. And also, I've, for your information, included a review article a few years back that reviews all the passive sampling devices and various extraction techniques if anyone's interested. So if you move to the next slide, we have the cell membrane that we're trying to mimic, and now we look at the a passive sampling device, in particular the one that I'm going to be talking about today, which is a lipid-free tube or lipid-free tube membrane. And some people may be familiar with passive sampling devices that are tubes filled with an oil. And those are called, one type of those types of passive sampling devices are called semipermeable membrane devices. And they're filled with Trillium, and they've been used for some years, initially developed by Hutkins et al. And so those are also fairly established in the literature. What you find is if you look at how much material is in the actual membrane versus the Trillium, depending on the deployment time and so forth, actually most of the contaminants are in the plastic, as it were, in the polyethylene membrane. And so really it just complicates the issue for many reasons, including modeling a three-phase water membrane and Trillium versus just a two-phase problem. In addition, there's other cleanup issues with Trillium. So in fact, we have done a little bit different cleanup procedure and eliminated the Trillium. And of course, on a molecular scale, the polymer, even though it looks like a thin piece of plastic on a molecular scale, of course, it's gigantic. And so the contaminants that are prone to sequester or diffuse into a lipophilic cell, or a lipophilic, in this case, passive sampling device, are in fact sequestered into the material. And from there, then we can extract them. So there's if we move to the next slide, there are several different attributes of passive sampling devices. And I'd just like to go through a couple of those. As I've mentioned already, the lipid-free tubes are constructed of a sealed polyethylene lay-flat tube, which represents the organic lipid member. And like the membrane, the LFTs discriminate, again, for both a chemical nature but also a physical nature. So particle-bound, in the same way, would not diffuse across a membrane, cell membrane would not diffuse into these by the physical size limitation. The in situ time integration, so as you can see from the pictures, we deploy these in water or air or sediment. The pictures shown here are a water deployment gear. And those are left in for some amount of time, again, depending on the fit for purpose and what we're doing. And those are sequestering over time. And so those have those have clear attributes. If you are looking at pulses of contaminants and don't know when they come across, and that's often the case in a river system as complex as the one that we're in, then that could be important. If the pulse of chemicals comes through at a slug from a particular incident, and it comes in at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's through the system where you have a sampler by 8 o'clock in the morning, if you're coming out at 9 o'clock in the morning taking a grab sample, you're going to miss it. However, as that pulse of contaminant comes through that river system, it comes across our passive sampling device and of course is sequestered. And so the time integration gives you a feel for what is that average concentration over the deployment time. And depending on the question you're asking, you could deploy these for hours or days or weeks or up to a month or so, depending on how you set them up. So again, it depends on the question, and then they have the capability of answering time-integrated questions that one might be interested in. The other attribute, then, is that because we can deploy these for extended periods of time to sequester contaminants, we overcome several issues that are often a nemesis of environmental chemists. And that is, a lot of times these concentrations of these analytes are very low and challenging, giving rich background matrices of muddy waters in harbors and at various estuaries and different types of environmental samples that you can imagine are going to have a lot of potentially rich background. And so by sequestering over time, you're concentrating that analyte in the passive sampling device. And so, in fact, what happens is, in the case of the analytes I'll talk about today, there are like PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and the passive sampling devices, in essence, and we can composite, as you can see, there's multiple passive sampling devices in these cages. We can composite those, and each one is sampling somewhere on the order of 50 to 100 liters, depending on the analyte. So by leaving them out for 10 days, it's like sequestering 1,000 liters of material. So I'm concentrating 1,000 liters. And I know that there are large volume sampler folks, but I'm a wimp and I don't like carrying 1,000 liters back to the laboratory from every site. So that is a way in which they can also help us. In addition to, of course, they're collecting a specific fraction. So if we go on to the next slide, you'll see a cartoon of how this all works with the bridges. So we have either a sediment or a water or an air exposure with the passive sampling device. I've pictured an air a cage like you saw in the previous slide in a cartoon here in the water. The samples are removed from the system and a dialysis hexane exchange. We don't use any chlorinated solvents. We do that three times, but those are sort of devil in the details. Do a solvent exchange depending on if we're going to go to do some chromatography to quantify the analytes, or we're going to go to the bioassay. And I'll talk more about the bioassay here in a few moments, but pictured there is our most specific bioassay that I'll talk about, which is a zebrafish. So in this way, very quickly and in a high throughput way, we can sample many different places in a system and sequester high concentrations from those high concentrations without doing much in the way of chemistry. That's pretty simple chemistry in the scheme of things compared to a lot of cleanup scenarios. We can get a sample that's an extract that goes to chemical analysis or bioassay. So if you go to the next slide, this would be slide 14 if you're keeping up. Then the bridges is really about processes and hopefully in environmental systems and biological systems where we're treating both those systems with the same modeling structure, and in this case, this particular bioanalytical tool, and hopefully that starts to present some consistency for exposures and effects. So again, trying to tie that environmental chemistry with the toxicology with one tool, to see if we can, in fact, validate this. If we move to the next slide, you can kind of see in another cartoon how this takes place. So I've already now described the environmental. We have a system where we deploy. We very quickly can do extractions of that passive sampling device in a very quick and fashion in a matter of hours, actually, from the time we're in the field. And then we can quantify a whole host of contaminants, which I'll talk about in a few moments, including things like PCBs, pHs, pH metabolites, etc. Those extracts then go into the biological system, in this case the zebrafish system that's been developed by a colleague of mine, Robert Tanguay, here at Oregon State University, as well as others. And we use that system because it has a lot of really significant advantages, which I'll talk about in a few moments. But some of the most important advantages is because we're high throughput on the environmental side, we really want to match this up with a high throughput system on the biological side. Because having high throughput on one side and not the other is really not high throughput. And in fact, we can do the zebrafish exposures in less than a week. They have it's again a whole body system, which is somewhat unique to a lot of bioassays. They're transparent, and so we can look at a lot of morphology changes without doing anything other than observing them under a microscope. So it's a nice in vivo full organism bioassay that has a lot of attributes, but probably most importantly for us is the high throughput character. If you go to the next slide, this is just summing up again, essentially the exposure of the mixtures to a biological response, just in words, what that picture is saying. If we go to the next slide, I'd like to talk a little bit about the passive sampling devices combining with the zebrafish. So as I've mentioned, this kind of just really summarizes linking that high throughput chemical side, environmental side, with the high throughput whole organism vertebrate bioassay. So if we move to the next slide, this is a slide where we're really, again, tying now the passive sampling device is really tying together what bioavailability is trying to do. So we're I'm trying to make the case here that this bioavailability is indeed essentially capturing what we want or the passive sampling device is capturing what we want the bioavailability to do from a conceptual standpoint. And there are other aspects of the passive sampling device that I won't have time to go into that include other questions about source and fate. So clearly the pH or other contaminant fingerprints can be used from the passive sampling device to be diagnostic of contaminant sources. I won't have time to talk about that. I'm going to talk a little bit about space and time on the left side, and I'm going to connect that up with the bioassays, as I said, and the zebrafish on the right side. But we also have air passive sampling units. So there's other aspects of that I won't have time to go into. And on the biological side, the organism exposure, bioconcentrations, and sample enrichment aspects I won't have time to go into. But what I'll be connecting are the space and time integrated flux with the bioassays. If you go to the next slide then, this is our deployment site, or one of our deployment sites. This is in a site in northern Oregon on the Willamette River. And what you see in this slide is the Willamette River flows north. In red is the Superfund Mega Portland Harbor site. It is called a mega site. It's nominally 6 miles long. And the river at the top is the Columbia River, so another big river system. And, of course, we have had various different sites that we've sampled from and have kind of settled over the last decade plus on these particular sites. River Mile 17, the Willamette River is nominally 175 miles long, so River Mile 17 is near the end as it flows into the Columbia River. We have in the Superfund River Mile 7 East, and that's actually also another Superfund site, a smaller less than 50-acre Superfund site that was a creosoting site. We have River Mile 7 West, almost directly across the river. This is a very industrial, as you can see from the satellite image. Harbor and then River Mile 3.5 and then River Mile 1 at the top, which is near the confluence with the Columbia River. If you go to the next slide, this is a blow up. And I'm just trying to get you to focus on a few sites. In particular, in this case, River Mile 7 West is on one side. There's a coal tar remediation upriver. This river is still influenced because of the closeness of the ocean. We do still get tidal surge, so we can get actually the river flowing the other way during tidal surge up through the Columbia. So as you see a plume of mud. You can see it actually goes both ways from where they were working on this particular satellite photo. And I wanted to show that because even when they're doing remediation, if it's only slightly downriver, we can actually see somewhat a fingerprint of that on some of our upriver sites. Then I'd like to point out on the other side, the capped creosote site. We've been looking at this site for years, and now it is no longer a Superfund site. It has been remediated and then further downriver. So I just wanted to show you how close River Mile 7 West is to River Mile 7 East. If you go to the next slide, here is some data. And what I've shown here are some spatial and temporal pHs in the Portland Harbor system. So on the one axis is River Mile. And so you see River Mile 7, and I have a few additional sites on this particular that I didn't show, but you can see from the river miles approximately where you are. In this case, I've just defined a dry season as less than an inch of rain, even though I know folks don't think that Oregon actually has a dry season. But we do have a little bit of a dry season, and the river looks quite different during that period when we have little rain. The river flow goes down substantially, and then, of course, the wet season is anything normally above 3 or 4 inches. And so we look at that and, in fact, see different signatures of pollutants in the system. And depending on pollutant class, they act differently. In the case of pHs, most of the pHs increase during the dry season, and we can talk about why that might be. Not always the case for other pollutant classes that we see. You also see at the Superfund site that the total pHs are quite high. So these are sort of some of the things that are important to see. Again, lots of tools for doing things, and using the right tool depends on the question, and certainly we want to make sure that the tool is fit for purpose. But in this case, some of the questions that we were asking was how much difference is there through the course of a year with pHs, and how does that affect, at this time we were looking at aquatic systems and specific critical life stages, and so it was important to look at these time points and get a feel for that. And this data is over a four-year period of dry season, wet season. And so, again, we see some high concentrations, but that's really, you know, I think that's why it was important for us to look at larger systems and trying to connect with the bioavailability is because this is only part of the story. Just real quickly, I think everyone's familiar with pHs in the pyrogenic. I'm on slide 22 now. Certainly with the combustion of organic material, natural or anthropogenic, but there are also petrogenic sources of pHs, and I think that I would be remiss as a person interested in pHs not to talk about for a minute or two the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. If you go to the next slide, we actually have water and air samplers in the Gulf of Mexico, and to orient you geographically, you can see the Deepwater Horizon site. Off the coast of Louisiana, off the coast of the Mississippi Delta. And we have samplers, air and water, in Grand Isle, Louisiana, up in Gulfport, Mississippi, and just south of Mobile in Alabama and in Pensacola, Florida. And so that's one of the things that passive sampling devices affords us. It affords us the opportunity to set up and monitor continuously, but also in a paired fashion, that we might not be able to do quickly. So we had our first samplers out actually in the 1st of May, and we're able to get some very good background data before the oil actually hit these areas. So if you go to the next slide, just kind of shows our deployment at some of these sites, which I've, again, already mentioned, our air and water. If you go to slide 25, What I'd like to just reiterate is, although the data I'm showing are PAHs, we can do a lot more than PAHs from the passive sampling devices. We can look, for example, at the 302 pH isomers, 302 molecular weight isomers. We can look at alkylated pHs, which is critical for doing source identification. Things that we're moving into are the oxygenated pHs, which are the ketone and quinone pHs, which are very important given the use of the dispersant, their potential bioavailability and toxicity. And then finally, we actually have a screening method, which I think is really imperative for when we're doing mixture assessments. We have a GCMS screening method where we're looking at over 1,200 analytes in the passive sampling device. And so with that, if you move to the next slide, you can see a little bit of the data from the Deepwater Horizon spill. This was actually in first week of May, and I haven't put the actual concentrations, but I wanted to have people have a sense of looking at not only the pHs, but the alkylated pHs, and certainly all those sites had pHs prior to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and so it was important to get what does that fingerprint look like before the spill, and there'll be lots of course questions related to getting it back to how that water was and how the air was, or how the air and water were before the spill, and so it was important for us to get pre-spill data. If you go to the next slide now, what I'd like to do is transition into the biological assay, and I see I need to go a little faster here, so I'll pick up the pace. So here are some pictures of some zebrafish embryos, and you can see the control at 30 hours post-fertilization and 126 hours post-fertilization. And then you can see what the embryos look like in an environmental exposure of 1% of an extract from the LFT. And I'm not going to show the dose response. We do get dose response. That was already published earlier this year, and we can certainly make that paper available. But since that's out, I want to show something new. And in part, if you go to the next slide, this is what I'd like to focus on, is here I have the percent incidence of various biological endpoints. So on the one axis is percent incidence, and on the other axis is geography. So I have river miles, and so downriver, or the control is in green if your colors are nominally the same as mine, and river mile 1. The reddish colors are the Superfund site, river mile 3, river mile 7 east, river mile 7 west, and then finally upriver, river mile 17. And what we found was that we had 6 of the 18 biological responses were significantly different in the exposed embryos compared to the controls. And I'd also like to point out, notice the N here. We had 941 fish, again, emphasizing the high throughput capacity of the Bridges, the passive sampling device, and the zebrafish bioassay really affords us the opportunity to have real statistical power. Not too many folks doing sampling have that kind of statistical power. So there's a couple things I want to point out with this. The first is, if you look at river mile 3.5, which is at the end of the Superfund, you see that we had, in fact, such high mortality at river mile 3.5 in the top two panels that we actually weren't able to assess sublethal effects. In contrast to that, if you look down at the lower two, couple of the lower panels, let's start with the very bottom panel, which is wavy notochord. Notice here that the only site that shows wavy notochord is river mile 7 west. If we go up to some of the other biological responses, we see that underdeveloped body or bent tail, for example, happens much higher at river mile 7 east. And so what we're able to see with this is that we're able to see that the in a river system, even just across the river, which is nominally 150 yards across, we see tremendous difference in the chemistry, and in fact, we see tremendous difference in the biological response. So this is some of the attributes of the bridges that we see even within a small system like Portland Harbor. We're able to discern these really fine details of the chemistry and the biological response. If you move to the next slide, what I have here are broken out the individual PAHs. Again, just represents a small subclass of the analytes that we have quantified. If I can bring your attention, so this is the exposure concentration exposure solution that the zebrafish were exposed to, and of course we did a dose response. But if I can bring your attention to benzoanthracene, and if you look, that one is the fourth one from the top. So if your screen color is normally the same as mine, it's kind of an aqua color. So it goes blue, red, some gosh awful green, and then the benzoanthracene aqua culture, aqua color. And you can see that it represents a pretty small component of the whole total PAH's exposure. In contrast, if you look at anthracene, which is the purple color near the bottom, so it goes yellow, blue, and purple, you can see anthracene makes up a large component of the total PAHs. So we can keep, and I realize there's a lot of information here, if you keep those two things in mind, let's go to the next slide. And what we saw was that, in fact, when we started looking at the biological response and the concentrations, it's trying to then unravel it, and this is always the nemesis. Well, don't do mixtures because one has to worry about how do you understand mixtures. Well, there are ways to break it all down, and the first pass is not just looking at concentration, but looking at the understanding what the relative toxicity is of this class of compounds. So, in fact, what we did was that we divided the concentrations by their chronic toxicity values. This is not something new. NEF has done this previously as well as others. And so in this way, we normalize the concentration by their relative toxicity. And so if I bring your attention to those two analytes again, benzoanthracene, again in that aqua color near the top, you see how now that has a much different profile as its contribution to the total pH. So now I've actually plotted these as hazard quotients, and you can see how big, for example, the benzoanthracene is in River Mile 3.5. In contrast, if we go back to the anthracene as an example, remember that was the purple bar, you see how it at the bottom, you can just see very little purple contributing. So it's in this way that we hope to be able to start to unravel the mixture component, but at the same time, understanding mixtures is important to looking at this. And how we unravel that is, of course, through looking at multivariate modeling methods, as well as separating out the chemistry. So we do both a separation of chemical classes and do subaliquots for the exposure, but then we also do multi-pattern recognition modeling methods. And those are hard to visualize and to put on a slide, but if you go to the next slide, a very simplistic model system, if you want to call it model in quotes, is very colorful. And here what we did was we just did a simple matrix where we multiply the percent incidence by the pH hazard quotient. And in this way, determine kind of, and there, obviously there's numbers here, and I just color-coded them because it's just a very simplistic way of starting to break down those mixtures to understand what is their relative contribution of individual pHs to the observed biological response. And if you look at this, of course, you see then benzoanthracene starts to show up with a lot of red and orange, both for mortality, notochord, yolk sac, edema, etc., and something like anthracene is pretty much low minimal impact. So obviously there's further ways to expand on this, but you could see where we're going with the approach. So if you go to the next slide, just to kind of start to wrap up, we can see that the embryonic zebrafish exposed to environmental contaminant mixtures from the passive sampling device does show site-specific biological responses. Those can be associated with the differences in the chemical profiles, and I just gave you some simplistic examples. The following slide shows, you know, potentially where we could take this. This is, for those of, of you in risk assessment world, are familiar with this equation for determining risk based on consumption of shellfish and fish. So you have your concentration in your fish and your exposure or your exposure duration, body weight, etc. And so we've actually started to look at using the passive sampling device and understanding what how that associates with various organisms relative to their class of compounds and inserting the passive sampling in as a surrogate to fish. Clearly, there's reasons for it very difficult for catching fish at specific sites, understanding how fish move between sites, metabolism. There's all kinds of things associated with catching fish, not the least of which is that sometimes we don't always want to kill a lot of fish to understand concentrations of contaminants, and so this could be a way of essentially being a surrogate for shellfish or fish. So finally then, if we just look at trying to connect the chemistry and biology, hopefully I've shown you what an inkling of the potential is for adding passive sampling concentrations to a health risk model, not only to increase spatial precision, as I showed you, even between River Mile 7 East and 7 West, but temporal position precision, as I showed you, there's over a factor of 2, in some cases a factor of 10 difference between different times in a system, and then hopefully in that way improve risk assessment, hopefully also reduce animal collection and cost. And passive sampling may be able to be used as a supplement to fish and shellfish data in a health assessment to provide not only, again, finer detail of spatial and temporal contamination information, and hopefully help public health and remediation professionals evaluate risk in that context. Finally then, if anyone's interested, if you go to slide 35, interested in passive, I've kind of listed a slew of advantages, and of course I'm aware of the disadvantages and we can talk about that. But I'd be glad to go into more detail if anyone has any questions. The next slide, slide 36, are a couple people I want to call out, Kevin Hobby, Sarah Allen, and Lane Tidwell. I've been working both in Portland Harbor, but also along with Stephen O'Connell, are working in the Gulf of Mexico. And then finally, acknowledge the group, in particular, Wendy Hillwalker did some of the zebrafish studies, and Julie Leshock did some of the early oxygenated pHs. And so, and then finally, Brian Smith has done some of the modeling, of which I've only shown you a portion of. So with that, I think I realize I've gone a good 10 minutes over, so I'll stop and take questions.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Anderson. I guess we have a little bit of time for a few questions, and of course we're just going with questions over the phone since we do not have a simulcast. So if you would like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute by pressing star 6, state your name, your organization, and go ahead and ask Dr. Anderson your question.
Charles, this is Jean. Just a correction. It's pound 6 to unmute your line.
Okay, thank you.
This is Audrey Elskis with the U.S. Geological Survey, and I have a question or maybe a comment about the using the way of converting concentration to relative toxicity. And I just wanted to emphasize that it only works in a mixture if all of the components are acting through the same mechanism of action, and so they can be considered additive.
Right. So but the caveat to that is that some of our endpoints are not don't have one mode of action either.
Right.
So,
but if they share them.
Right. But so it goes both ways. It is not the same mode of action. There isn't a single mode of action that causes edema. There could be many things going on. So both sides of it aren't intended to suggest that. Ultimately, there are different ways in which there are different tools that Dr. Tangwe is using to assess individual mechanistic components within the zebrafish system, the zebrafish model system.
So, in effect, with the mixtures, then it's just an estimate of relative toxicity because of that.
Well, it's only a measure of a certain kind of toxicity, right? I mean, for instance, this model system doesn't assume cancer at all as an endpoint. So
no,
that would be something like the Ames, the Ames assay, which we do, or what in certainly cancer is not an endpoint, so it's not taking that into account either.
But this had several different ones, right? Because you had mortality, the body,
mm-hmm.
the bent tail.
Right. There's nominally 18 or so endpoints that we look at.
So do you feel, though, that you can use this with confidence to assign relative percent of contribution of those different PAHs to all of those different endpoints?
Well, what we're doing is looking at that. Those toxicity values are in the literature. So we didn't assign those. We took those out of the literature. So the hazard, the chronic toxicity values, we took from the literature and applied those to the concentration to see how that would match up or not match up with the biological responses.
Okay. So I'll send you an email because I don't
sure.
want to labor.
Sure. No, I appreciate it, Audrey. Thank
okay.
you.
This is Charles Maurice. I have with EPA. I just wanted to follow up on that question and try to get your thoughts on the idea of how. Well, first of all, the question of how when you are doing assessing the matrix as you laid it out in your slides. Comparing the different proportions or amounts, and you just did it very qualitatively, for the different responses. Do you, when you're trying to get to the end of the day for risk values, do you go, what would your recommendation be using that your type of approach with chemical mixture of different PAHs such as you have?
Well, we have,
or a different for selecting which response you're going to go with, or you go with the response that exhibits the greatest sensitivity or the greatest impact on the organism, or how would you go about that?
So it's kind of an iterative process that we envision. So part of it is looking at the whole mixture, and there's going to be, of course, the modeling approach that goes with that. But concurrent with that is that we can start, we have one, is my colleague Robert Tangwe, is looking at building a single at a time PHS. So, for instance, he's looking at individually benzothiophene and various other individuals. So we're kind of coming at opposite ends and hope to meet in the middle. What we're doing is slicing the mixtures into subgroups. So chemically we can start to slice out via chemical separation various classes of chemicals so that we're exposing to a smaller and smaller subgroup of the chemicals, and presumably looking at how slicing out various chemicals then starts affecting which and how much of those biological responses we continue to see in order to start to unravel it. But it is a iterative process. At the same time, with the modeling, there are several folks now for about the last 10 years were looking at actually not even knowing the chemical, but knowing how a particular analyte that hasn't been identified only by number in the chromatography has been shown to strongly associate with a response. And through that modeling, those get identified. So we're ahead of the curve in the sense that we know over 1,000 chemicals in our extracts And so with that, we also hope the modeling will be able to feed back into what individual chemicals or groups of chemicals are starting to have the biggest impact on specific biological responses.
Okay, excellent. I think we better move on, and I'll just mention here that there will be time at the end after Dr. Chen's presentations. We'll have a just question period for her specifically, and then we'll open it up for questions to for both speakers. So if you do have a question for Dr. Anderson, just hold on to it toward the end. I want to give Dr. Chen her full amount of time, so I'd like to start with her presentation. Dr. Celia Chen is an aquatic ecologist whose research over the last 15 years has focused on the fate and effects of metal contaminants in aquatic food webs, both in freshwater and estuarine ecosystems. She has studied the bioavailability and bioaccumulation of mercury and other metals such as arsenic, cadmium, lead, and zinc in benthic and pelagic invertebrates and trophic transfer to fish. She has conducted metal bioavailability studies in the laboratory using freshwater and estuarine crustaceans in fish, and has also investigated metal bioaccumulation and trophic transfer in field studies in lakes and estuaries in the northeast United States. Her research questions focus on chemical and ecological factors that influence metal uptake, including salinity, natural organic matter, feeding strategy, and food web structure. She has been interested in identifying the factors that influence system-to-system variability in mercury bioaccumulation and has been assessing the relative importance of ecological processes to better understand mercury bioaccumulation in a variety of aquatic ecosystems. Lastly, she and her colleagues are developing Daphnia and killifish microarrays as biomarkers of metal exposure. Dr. Chen, the phone is yours.
Thank you very much, and thanks everyone for inviting our Superfund program through me to do this, and also for setting this up today and getting through all the technical difficulties. Well, I just wanted to say that I'm part of the Dartmouth Superfund Basic Research Program that has been running since 1995, and we have a lot of biomedical and non-biomedical projects that involve both arsenic and mercury especially, and we've been collaborating with one another through the years. Today I'm going to talk about some of the work that we've been doing over the years, summarizing some of it to tell you about the story of the fate of mercury in aquatic ecosystems. And in this project, in our Superfund project, we've also, as was mentioned, that we've also worked on arsenic, cadmium, and lead, but today I'm just going to talk about mercury. So I'm moving on from the title slide to number 43, the where, what, and how. Well, we've been interested in looking at mercury fate, bioaccumulation, and trophic transfer in both lakes and estuaries, as was mentioned. And we've been interested in understanding why different systems vary in the degree to which mercury and methylmercury are bioaccumulated and transferred in those food webs. Often, the inputs to those systems are very much the same. For example, lakes that are in very close proximity to one another and not at all affected by any major point sources, but in fact that the bioaccumulation in those lakes can be very different in terms of the amount of mercury that gets to fish that humans consume. And in talking about mercury, we focus on that particular metal because of its importance to the issues of exposure and risk to humans and wildlife. We have been using a combination of approaches in our work. We do a lot of field work and also laboratory and field experiments. Today I'm going to talk about some of our field work and our mesocosm studies that we've done in both lakes and another study that we've been working on in intertidal zones in estuaries. Going on to slide 44, there's many reasons why there are many mechanisms that affect mercury bioaccumulation, including chemical, physical, and biological. I wanted to talk today about some of the ecological processes that we've been studying that seem to influence mercury bioaccumulation. And so before I talk about them, I'm going to clarify what I mean when I talk about each one. Trophic transfer, we say that occurs when concentrations in predators are related to concentrations in their prey, assuming that the prey are actually the vector from which the predators obtain their metal burden. Biomagnification, you're probably mostly aware of, is when metal concentrations increase with the level of the food chain. Biomass dilution is a term that we refer to when the metal concentration decreases with the increasing biomass of, in our case, we are going to be talking about plankton biomass. And then feeding pathway is where we've been trying to distinguish for certain metals the route through which the metals are transferred into the food web, whether it's from the benthic food web or the pelagic food web. And I'll talk about that more in our estuarine work. On to slide 45. Well, as you may all know, the main route of exposure for humans to mercury is through fish consumption. This is a map that is reflects the fish advisories issued by states as of December 2008. And many states have statewide lake advisories, and most of the states on the Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico have statewide coastal advisories as well nowadays. In fact, the greatest increases in advisories over the last 15 years have been for mercury in contrast to other contaminants. There were 3 million only in 1993, and now there are over 17 million lake acres now covered by advisories as of 2008. They're very useful for trying to at least inform the public, but they don't identify areas that are particularly high in mercury. On to slide 46. Also, many of you probably know that methylmercury is a neurotoxin. Most of it, the humans that are exposed to it mostly through diet, and because it's a neurotoxin, of course, the central nervous system and brain and the brain is certainly affected. And it impairs speech. It results in acute exposures, impairment of movement and vision, and chronic exposures has known to be related to developmental delays and learning disabilities, as well as cardiovascular effects. The central nervous system of the developing fetus is the most vulnerable, as are the central nervous systems of young children, and therefore pregnant women and children are the most at-risk populations. Many of us know about mercury toxicity because of the Mad Hatter, the hatters that were that use mercury, inorganic mercury, in the making of felted hats, and also the exposure of the Minamata population due to the production of chloralkali production in Minamata Bay, and their exposure, although extremely acute, was through the consumption of seafood. On to slide 47. When we talk about mercury, we have to talk about the speciation. It's extremely important in terms of its transport and its fate, as well as its bioavailability. So if we just go from the top, we have elemental HG0, elemental mercury. That is the form that is most prevalent in the atmosphere, and it has extremely long residence times of half a year to 2 years, and that is why it's atmospherically transported so to such great degree globally. Oxidized HG2+ is the dominant form in the atmosphere and in water, and it is the dominant form in water. It incorporates both reactive gaseous mercury and particulate mercury, both of which are inorganic forms that have different half-lives in the atmosphere. But most importantly, in terms of biological systems, monomethylmercury, the last one is the most toxic form and the most bioavailable form. And in aquatic ecosystems, the biomagnification of that particular form of mercury is what makes it such a problem in aquatic food webs in terms of exposure to fish consumers. On to the next slide, 48. This is a nice schematic of sort of the fate of mercury that comes from a Hubbard Brook Research Foundation Science Links report. And it just shows that for atmospheric sources, they are mercury is emitted into the atmosphere and then transported and brought down onto the landscape through wet and dry deposition. And that can be near or far from its source. In the watershed, it eventually is transported to the sediments of water bodies where most of the conversion of the inorganic mercury, the Hg2+, is made into methylmercury, and then that is where it is exposed to the aquatic food chain. It can increase up to 10 million times from the concentrations in water to obligate piscivores like loons. And as I said before, this exposure is really largely through fish consumption. This is a diagram on the next slide, number 49, that shows the in-lake mercury processes. This is from a USGS schematic on the Everglades. And basically, as I said before, inorganic or Hg2 enters the water, and the methylation occurs largely down in the sediments. You can see in the diagram, the red is Hg2. It goes to yellow, which is the methylmercury, and from the sediments, a portion remains in the sediments, but also some of it is fluxed into the water column. And there is a certain amount of flux of inorganic mercury back into the water. There is a process of evasion of the inorganic mercury, the elemental mercury in blue back from the water into the atmosphere. So there's always that these processes going on. But as you can see from the diagram that there is the methylation and then the biouptake of both the inorganic and the methylmercury by the phytoplankton. They have a picture there, phytoplankton to the invertebrates and zooplankton and up into the fish. There's also a certain amount of methylation that occurs in the water column. This is mostly in the oceans where they've measured a certain amount of methylation that goes on at the base of the oxygen minimum zone where there are reducing conditions and a good amount of carbon substrate and also available inorganic mercury. So it isn't only in the sediments, but for the most part in aquatic in freshwater ecosystems, the dominant source of mercury methylation is in the sediments. The next slide, number 50, just shows this is from a bioscience paper by Charlie Driscoll et al., who have gathered data from a bunch of studies from the Northeast to show what the biomagnification of mercury and the percent of mercury as methylmercury are. And you can see the increasing in both the top and the bottom panels, the increase from water methylmercury and water, or water and up to loons is increasing, of course, showing the methylmercury. But you can also see even as the total of the mercury is increasing on the bottom panel from water up to loons, the percent of the total that is methylmercury is also increasing. So that in water where you have maybe 2% to 10% of the total as methylmercury, by the time you reach loons, you have and piscivorous fish, you have about 95% of the total as methylmercury. So the biomagnification of the toxic and most bioavailable form, of course, makes the exposure to piscivores much, much greater. On to the next slide, slide 51. Just I want to sort of introduce some of the field approaches in lakes that we've used to study methylmercury and mercury fate in lake ecosystems. On to 52. Well, when we have been studying food webs, we've focused mostly on pelagic food webs in freshwater ecosystems. And those are comprised of phytoplankton and zooplankton, planktivorous and piscivorous fish, those planktivorous fish eating plankton and piscivorous fish eating fish. And we've used in some of our past works the US EPA EMAP data sets to characterize food webs across multiple lakes in the region in terms of food web characteristics, so among them being food web chain or food web length or chain length, food web complexity, which is basically related to the diversity of organisms within each food trophic level and the interconnections between them. And so we try to characterize food webs by some of these structural variables and then also relate them to the mercury bioaccumulation in each level of the food chain. In the past, our studies and others have shown one of the more repeatable results has been that the chain length of the food web has been very much positively related to the amount of mercury in the top trophic level fish. So all else being equal, those chain those food webs that have more trophic levels have higher mercury levels in their top trophic level fish. On to the next slide, number 53. This is just a map that shows the 20 lakes that we have studied in the Northeast. They were selected from an EMAP surface water data set, and we then went and sampled over two field seasons to measure a lot of environmental variables like water chemistry, as well as phytoplankton and zooplankton samples, and we used metal concentration data that EMAP had collected prior to our study. Their data were on whole-bodied fish samples, not just the fillets. We wanted to use those data because in thinking about what the predators of fish would actually be exposed to, it would not necessarily just be the fillets. We tried in our study to span a large geographic range. You can see that pretty much sites ranging from Maine all the way down to Connecticut and New York, and pretty much Dartmouth College campus is in the center of all of those dots. It was they were all within about 3 hours travel from our campus. The lake characteristics of the lakes that we studied are shown on the next slide in 54. As I said, we tried to span a broad range geographically, but we also tried to span a broad range of lake characteristics so that we had very small lakes that were only 5.5 hectares to over 900 hectares, and the depths went from very, very shallow lakes to rather deep lakes, and pH ranges were from just below neutral to fairly basic pH. In the next slide, number 55, just wanted to describe how, I guess, challenging it can be to collect samples for mercury, particularly in low biomass samples like plankton. It's very easy to contaminate your own samples, so it's imperative that we use pretty meticulous trace metal clean technique in terms of clean hands, dirty hands technique. It requires literally four hands of two people in order to collect these samples. And we've become quite anal about how our sampling equipment is cleaned and stored in terms of acid cleaning and double bagging and all of that, all taken out to the field. We collected two size fractions of zooplankton to get an idea of the smaller versus the larger and their whether there are differences in the amount of mercury bioaccumulation. We collected all our samples using non-metallic plankton nets and filtered them onto acid-clean Teflon filters. We also took taxonomy samples so that we could calculate food web structure variables, like I mentioned earlier, chain length, complexity, species richness, etc. We also calculated BMFs, which are biomagnification factors, using the metal data on zooplankton and fish. I'm not going to talk about all of those results. I just want to show you some results that have given us some idea of some of the mechanisms influencing mercury bioaccumulation. So on to slide 56. We couldn't do any of this work without our collaboration with our Trace Element Analysis Core facility that's part of our Superfund research program. Our director, Brian Jackson, and past directors, Stefan Stirrup, have all been a real integral part of our research in terms of how we do it, how developing our sampling techniques, and particularly for them, developing methods that are required for high precision measurements of mercury and methylmercury on extremely low biomass samples. That's been a real challenge for us, and we've really learned from them how to do this. They have a high resolution inductive leak coupled plasma mass spectrometer, spectrophotometer, and we and that is what they run our metal samples on. They also do mercury speciation analysis using isotope dilution purge and trap. And so it's important for us that they are able to do mercury speciation so that on a single sample we can determine the amount of methylmercury and inorganic mercury in that sample so that we have a good measurement of what the percent of the total is that is methylmercury. And if you have any questions about our methods, I can refer you to papers in which a number of these methods have been discussed. On to the next slide. Well, these figures come from this 20-lake study, some of the figures that come from that study. And what we found from looking at the variation in mercury bioaccumulation across these 20 lakes is that if you look at the left panel, which has log particulate mercury concentration on the y-axis and log chlorophyll on the x-axis, we find that chlorophyll as a measure of phytoplankton biomass, as that increases, we seem to see a decrease in the amount of mercury that's in that phytoplankton biomass. And similarly, on the right panel, we see that for zooplankton, the greater the amount of zooplankton abundance shown on the x-axis, the lower the amount of mercury in that fraction of zooplankton. So there appears to be some sort of a biomass dilution of the mercury across these range of lakes. And in each of these panels, each dot represents a single lake. And so this biomass dilution is something that appears across this range of study sites. If we go to the next slide, slide 58, you can see it plotted on the left-hand panel is fish concentration on the y-axis for mercury, and on the x-axis is zooplankton abundance. The left panel is small zooplankton abundance, and the right panel is large zooplankton abundance. And for both panels, you can see that for small zooplankton and for large zooplankton, the greater the amount of zooplankton you have in the system, the lower the amount of mercury is bioaccumulated in fish. Again, suggesting that perhaps the increase in abundance of plankton biomass, or the abundance of plankton, or the increase in plankton biomass is somehow diluting the mercury that's in that part of the food web. If you go to the next slide, 59, I we saw that in our 20 lakes, this potential biomass dilution. What we then wanted to do was to look at a bigger data set in which we included data from two REMAP programs. These are regional EMAP programs, the Vermont-New Hampshire REMAP, and as well as the Maine REMAP program, and also other lakes in the EMAP program that are the green triangles. Our study that I just talked about is the black squares, and you can see those on the map. So by adding, looking at this larger set of multi-lake data sets, we increased the range of our lakes by quite a bit. And in these data sets, we wanted to see whether similar kinds of predictors of mercury in fish would emerge from the same analysis of those data. If you go to the next slide, 60, what this shows is the variables that we had for each of the data sets. The first column says NIEHS, that's our study, the 20 lake study, and you can see all of the variables that we had from that data set. The REMAP and Vermont, REMAP Vermont-New Hampshire data set has fewer, and the EMAP has slightly fewer than that, and the Maine REMAP data set had the fewest. But, and because each of the data sets was different, we actually had to analyze them each separately using Spearman-Rank correlation, and from that try to determine whether there were common variables that predicted higher mercury in fish. The bottom of that table says mercury concentration, and you can see that we had aqueous concentrations for mercury in two of the data sets, and the other two we didn't, as well as mercury in zooplankton in two of the data sets. But we had mercury in fish concentration data for all four of the data sets. Well, as I said, on to the next slide, 61, we couldn't analyze them in one big meta-analysis because the methods and the variables weren't the same across all of the data sets. So we looked at each separately, and this table is organized by the kinds of, in the first column, variable category, the kind of variable, whether it be physical, chemical, land use, or ecological variable, what those the variables were that were predictive of mercury in fish. And then in the last column, what the relationship of that variable was to mercury in fish. So for example, in the top category of physical variables, we have lake area. In three out of the four, that's what the three-fourths means, three out of the four data sets, lake area was positively associated with mercury in fish. And in watershed area, two out of the three data sets that had watershed area as a variable were also positively associated with mercury in fish. So the larger the lake or watershed area, the greater the amount of mercury in fish. That seems intuitively makes sense because the area for deposition and sort of collection of the mercury into the system is greater. And under chemical variables, we have pH and alkalinity being negatively associated with mercury in fish, and that has been shown in other studies. It does appear that more acidic lake ecosystems have greater methylation and also greater mercury bioaccumulation in biota. We also see that in both lakes that had sulfate and two out of the three of the lakes that had nutrient data, that there is also a negative relationship. So the greater the amount of nutrient in the ecosystem, the lower the amount of mercury in fish. And then in terms of land use, that was probably our most non-intuitive result, was that the land use, the more residential, agricultural, commercial, industrial, the land use, the lower the mercury in fish. So land that, lakes that had shorelines with greatest human impact had lower mercury in fish, and that was very surprising to us. And then finally, under ecological, we found in three out of the four data sets that zooplankton abundance, just like we had seen in our own data set, appears to be negatively related to mercury in fish. Lakes that have high zooplankton density also have have lower mercury that gets transferred to fish. And so from this set of field studies, we seem to see that there's some relationship of nutrients, as we had seen before. Nutrients are potentially related to higher plankton abundances, and maybe there's a biodilution. There's a land use effect that is probably associated with nutrients. The more human land use, there's probably more nutrient that is going into those systems. And plankton density seems to really be predictive of mercury in fish as well. Well, we wanted to test this and go on to the next slide, 62, and use an experimental approach in mesocosms to see whether there was something to this biomass dilution and trophic transfer hypothesis that was emerging from our field work. And on to the next slide, number 63, what we did, we then decided we would use cattle tanks as mesocosms and do to look at in-lake food web processes. And we wanted to answer two questions. Number one was, how does nutrient enrichment affect mercury bioaccumulation in algae? And number two, does that then transfer to zooplankton? Do the zooplankton mercury burdens decrease with increased algal density? This research that I'm going to talk about here is really was largely the work of Paul Picard for his PhD thesis as a Superfund research program trainee, and this is one of his published papers. On to slide 64, what we had was a design in which there were two tanks at each nutrient level and six nutrient levels treatments across the tanks. In the tanks, the nitrogen and phosphorus ratio, the N to P ratio was all 30:1 for N to P. We tried to maintain the same ratio so that the assemblages of zooplankton would not change in terms of their taxonomic composition. And the reason that we were able to really do this kind of experiment was because we collaborated with our trace element core and used stable isotopes of mercury to track the movement of mercury through the food web components and measured mercury bioaccumulation in algae and in zooplankton. The highest nutrient tanks, the eutrophic tanks, had six times the nutrient concentrations of the lowest nutrient treatments. On to the next slide. If we, this is a plot of what happened to the algae in the tanks across the nutrient treatments. On the x-axis, you have the phosphorus concentrations. Each of those dots is a tank. And if you go from the left to the right on the x-axis, you can see, you know, that it's the treatments of going from the low to the high phosphorus additions. And with the increase in phosphorus, you can see that there was an increase in chlorophyll, which suggested that the increased nutrient additions did cause algal productivity and algal blooms to occur. Going on to the next slide, number 66. Well, in those same tanks, the x-axis here is the same on both of these graphs of the phosphorus concentrations from left to right, low to high. But the y-axis here is the mercury concentration in the phytoplankton. And as you can see, with the increase in, on the left-hand panel, the increase in inorganic phosphorus resulted in a decrease in methylmercury in the phytoplankton. And also on the right panel, also a decrease in inorganic mercury on the in the phytoplankton. So here we have, at 24 hours after the addition of the stable isotope, we can see that there is the increased algal biomass has resulted in a decrease in the amount of uptake on a per biomass basis of the mercury by the algal cells. On to the next slide, number 67. If we look at the zooplankton in those tanks at 3 weeks, and we look specifically at Daphnia, which is a pretty important component of these lake food webs, we can see that, in fact, here the y-axis is the mercury concentration in the zooplankton, that for methylmercury on the left-hand panel, there is a decrease in methylmercury bioaccumulation in zooplankton with increasing phosphorus. So here we see the transfer of this biodilution of methylmercury in the algae to the zooplankton. And then on the other hand, on the right-hand panel, we can see that, in fact, the inorganic mercury doesn't show a nutrient effect at all. And so it appears that the methylmercury is affected in terms of this biomass dilution. So from our experimental work, then, we see that the nutrients do increase the algal biomass, which appears to decrease and biodilute mercury in the algae, and then that ultimately reduces the methylmercury transfer to zooplankton. The next slide, segue into the work that we've done a little bit in the coastal marsh ecosystems and looking at feeding pathways. Slide 69 is an illustration of the kinds of food webs we're working in there. These are much more associated with the sediments, and so we are working with both benthic and sediment, benthic and pelagic organisms. In this case, you can see in this illustration, the reason we chose to work here is because of something called the trophic nekton relay. And the idea there is, as you go in this illustration from the right side of the illustration, more left, you're going from inshore to offshore, and from the intertidal zone to the subtidal zone. And the organisms that whose names are written in red are really what are considered resident species, and they are very they have site fidelity to certain areas of sediment. Whereas if you look to the left side of the illustration, we have organisms written in blue, like Atlantic silversides, flounder, sticklebacks, striped bass. Those are what we call transient species, and those are the ones moving in and out of the intertidal zone, feeding on the organisms that stay in one place, basically in the intertidal zone. And in doing so, they are transferring energy and carbon and contaminants from the intertidal to the subtidal and eventually offshore. And so we studied organisms that are that have the pink square rectangle around them because they're resident and because they would effectively be related to the sediment concentrations on which they're living. On to the next slide, number 70. We studied sites that were in the Gulf of Maine that really ranged across a contamination gradient from a very pristine site up in Mount Desert Island, Maine, to much more industrialized sites like Portsmouth, New Hampshire, near the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. Actually, Providence is not in the data set that I'm going to show you, but it was in one of our subsequent studies. On to the next slide, number 71. In these studies, we sampled for, as I said, the four taxonomic groups that were in that first illustration included snails and mussels, which are primary consumers, and secondary consumers were the killifish and green crabs, both who are omnivorous. They eat lots of different things, including other animals. In the metal analysis, we used whole organisms and freeze-dried and homogenized them, and then at our trace element analysis core, they did mercury speciation using isotope dilution, Purgeon trap. We also collected samples. We also used a portion of the samples for analysis of stable isotopes, both C13 and N15. C13 is a good marker for what the carbon source of the organism is, whether the source is mostly pelagic versus benthic, and N15 is indicates how high a trophic level entrophic level the organism is in the food web. On to 72. These are some data from those four sites, and what you can see in the top panel A is that These are sediment concentrations across the four sites. And across the four sites, we have sediment mercury concentrations that vary by over 200 times, so two orders of magnitude difference. If you then go down to panel B and C, you'll see these are from two different years, 2003 in panel B and 2004 in panel C. The concentrations of mercury, this is total mercury, in the four taxa. So you can see on the y-axis, the taxa are, the black bars are from Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. The striped are from Adams Point, which is in Wells, Maine. Mount Desert Island, which is one of the, Adams Point is near, is in Great Bay, New Hampshire, and Mount Desert Island, MDI, and then Wells is our cleanest site. And what you can see is from the most contaminated down to the cleanest site, we have very enormous amounts of variability in the concentrations of total mercury in the sediments. In the organisms, and plus you don't see much of a relationship necessarily with the amounts that are in the sediment, the total amounts of mercury in the sediment. So that was surprising to us. If you go to the next slide, this is a slide that shows in the top panel the stable isotope, the C13 signature, and as you can see from the benthic and then the arrow and pelagic on the right, that the more, or I should say the less depleted or the less negative the value for delta C13, the more benthic the food source. And the more negative or the more pelagic it is. So as you can see for the top panel, middleists, which are mussels, are extremely pelagic. They have the most depleted delta C13. They are filter feeders. They, you know, take particulates out of the water column, and so they're pelagic feeders. Whereas the Litorina, which are the snails on the far right bar, and the green crabs, Carcinus, are very much more benthic feeders. They're eating detrital material and periphyton that are growing on the surface of the sediments. In contrast, the bottom panel shows the concentration of methyl mercury across those different taxonomic groups and within each taxonomic group, the four sites. And what you can see is the pattern of higher methylmercury concentrations in those taxa that are most depleted in delta C13. So in other words, we find that the organisms that are feeding more from the pelagic zone are actually have higher methylmercury concentrations, whereas those feeding directly on the sediments have lower methylmercury concentrations. Now, that was also surprising to us in some ways because, in fact, there is a lot of methylmercury in the sediments, but somehow it's not as bioavailable as it is when it's in the water column. And then on to the next slide, 74, if we look at the top panel is N15. So as I said before, the higher the N15 signature, the higher the trophic level. And what you can see there is in the bottom panel, we have the proportion of mercury as methylmercury in the bottom panel. And that seems to correlate, and it does statistically as well, with the trophic level. So in this shows that the higher the trophic level, even given the variability across sites, the higher the trophic level, the higher the percent of the total is methylmercury in these organisms. And then finally, this last set of graphs shows the relationship between something called the benthic sediment concentration factor, which is a way to normalize the amount of metal or contaminant in the organisms by dividing their concentrations by the amount in the sediments. And once doing that, we then looked at the relationship of the benthic sediment concentration factor with both organic carbon, total organic carbon in the sediments on the left panel, and with SCM minus AVS, simultaneously extracted metal minus acid volatile sulfides, on the right panel. And what these two graphs show is that basically the more organic carbon that you have in the sediments, the less bioavailable the metal is to the organism. It's very much driven by the amount of organic carbon, and also there is some role of acid volatile sulfide as well, since there is also a relationship there between bioavailability measured as BSCF and between SEM minus AVS. We can talk about that more if people have questions about it. So I guess in conclusion in terms of the estrine data, we really see that there's enormous sediment variability in concentration, but that the organisms don't show that variability, don't reflect it at all in terms of their bioaccumulation. And also that there is a really important role that organic carbon plays in the bioavailability of mercury to these food webs. Onto the next slide, my overall conclusions, slide 76, is that I hope I've shown you that the metal fate, and particularly mercury and methylmercury fate, is really determined by some ecological processes, trophic transfer, biomagnification, biomass dilution, and also the feeding pathway through which they get their carbon and food, and that these processes are present across lake and estuarine systems. And finally, I have to acknowledge all of my many, many collaborators. There's more than are on any, even on this slide, but Carol Folt, who has been my collaborator in our Superfund research program and has worked with me on all of our lake work, has been important in all of this research. And our current Trace Element Core director is Brian Jackson, and others are Vivian Taylor, Jason Williams, Deanie Bouguet, and Darren Ward, and other collaborators and other institutions. I mentioned Paul Picard's work. Neil Kamen has collaborated with me. He's worked in Vermont. And Michelle Dion with the estuarine work at Wells, and Dave Evers, and Brandon Mays as well. And I take any questions if anyone has any.
Thank you, Dr. Chen. I'd like to take a question or two from the phone lines before we open it up to either presenter. So, if you want to ask a question, to take your phone off mute, press the #6 buttons on your phone, and then state your name, your organization, and ask your question.
Hi, this is Audrey Elskis.
Hi, Adria.
Hi, Julia. I wanted to ask you, with all these data that you have you begun building models to make predictions about where you expect the mercury to show up in organisms in different lakes?
Yeah, well, actually, interestingly enough, we haven't been building a lake food web model. We have been working on an estuarine food web model. That's actually Darren Ward, our postdoc, has been working on that model. That's a really good point, actually. We haven't really taken the data from our lakes to model that, but that sounds like a really great project for a new postdoc. And if you have any ideas, we should talk more about it. We have so much data, as you can see, and I know we've talked about that before. So, yeah, it's not something we're working on right now anyway.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for Dr. Chen before we open it up to both Dr. Chen and Dr. Anderson? Well, someone wants to say something.
Hi, my name is Jen Wallenberg, and I had a question about Dr. Chen's results from the estuarine study. And it seems like your findings, I guess it's on slide 75, it seems like it indicates that bioavailability potentially increases with higher ABS concentrations. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about mechanistically why that might be.
Well, actually, it's because if I should have said something, the axis is backwards, so it's more negative as you go to the left. But so, in other words, the more well, so I guess what it is the more metal there is relative to the AVS, right? So you have to think of it flipped. And so it actually is sort of the more AVS there is, the less bioavailability there is. And that was actually really surprising to us. You know, mercury is not one of those, I mean, even though there is binding to sulfides, I didn't expect the SEM AVS data to come out in the, you know, as significant. But we actually have another data set where it shows the same. So seems to be for mercury and for methylmercury as well. There seems to be a relationship with SEM AVS.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, well, before we open the question and answer session to both presenters, I wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the an online feedback form. I realize that the clue-in is down today, but hopefully it'll be back tomorrow, and certainly it will be back up in the future. You'll find on the links page that we've assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so that you can access it at least as long as Kulin is up and operating, which is almost all the time. Really, it has a very good track record. We typically place the seminars in the archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was presented today, complete with the audio. And associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We would like you to consider filling that online form, feedback form out. Again, that would have to be tomorrow or the next day. We do look at your comments, and we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback form page can be found on the last slide of the presentation. And again, if you go to the live form as opposed to the canned presentations, I don't think you'll be able to get the live link on the from the presentations if you've captured them from the static files, but if you can get to them from when they're live, when Zoom is back up again. So I would like to now open the question and answer session to either Dr. Anderson or Dr. Chen, and if you have a question, again, turn off your mute by pressing #6, state your name and organization, and then ask your question.
Dan Michael, Neptune & Company. Another question on the methylation of mercury. I'm wondering, all of your studies focused on the Northeast, and I'm interested in your thoughts about how the methylation processes and these factors you measured might change if you get down into Southeast or really different types of systems.
I really think that the mechanisms are pretty similar. I think a lot of what we've learned about, you know, and this is a very large community of people who study methylmercury, that we've learned about methylmercury actually has come from the Everglades and what goes on in that system. I think that even though the mechanisms are similar, the importance of different factors changes a lot depending on what system we're talking about. For example, dissolved organic carbon is in stream and river systems is really, really important in delivery of transport of mercury, but there is some evidence to suggest that DOC can also reduce bioavailability of mercury for methylation, and that differs in systems depending on, you know, the amount of DOC or how important DOC is in that kind of system. There have been a number of, and I could put this on the website as well, reports that have come out from USGS as well as EPA. USGS has done extensive mercury work in a lot of river systems throughout the country. I think that the differences probably have to do with the kind of system. For instance, we know that reservoirs have greater methylation potential and higher mercury in fish in reservoirs relative to natural lakes. So I don't know if that answers your questions, but I think the mechanisms are similar, but the conditions are different across those different kinds of systems. And in terms of region, east to west, well, the east to west difference is largely probably a difference in deposition and sources of deposition of mercury.
Does anyone else have a question?
Hello, my name's Wayne Richter. I'm with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Question for Dr. Anderson. How do you relate the concentrations that you pick up on your samplers and that you're applying to the zebrafish to ambient concentrations and get to some kind of environmental relevance?
Yeah, so the concentration actually that I showed you at 1% in that particular case, that was nominally an environmental concentration. That's why we diluted it back. So had we run that at 100%, it would have been 100-fold what we would have saw in the environment. So typically somewhere, so we can't, because we use performance reference compounds in the devices, we can easily calculate back what the water concentration is. Normally when we do our dose exposures, one of the concentrations that we use in that dose exposure is essentially the equivalent of a water concentration. The advantage that the passive sampler gives us is normally that would be the highest concentration you would ever be able to do an exposure to, but because it's concentrating or sequestering sequestering the contaminants, we can do higher doses.
So could you explain a little bit more how you get from the concentration in the sampler back to the ambient water concentration? That's the part I miss.
Well, I didn't go into it because I'm always afraid to start throwing math around. If you go to, if you still have the slide presentation up, if you go to slide 36, I believe, 38. So in the passive sampling devices, we infuse or otherwise spike into the devices labeled compounds. So for in the case of pHs, we do lots of them because there's lots of labeled compounds. And so if you know what the elimination rate constant is because of the amount that you've spiked into it, you can know the uptake rate. So the change in concentration that we can measure with our spiked performance reference compounds, we know how much we put in them and we know how much is in there at the end of the deployment, we can calculate a KE, an elimination uptake rate, and therefore we know a KU uptake rate. So all of the other compounds, the non-deuterateds, we know the uptake rate because we know the KE elimination rate. So in the case of the pHs, we have the labeled compounds. In case of the PCBs, we have labeled, and then we have a select group of pesticides that are labeled. And so in that way, we can calculate what the uptake rate is. So then it's a question of if you know what the uptake rate is, if you go to slide 39, this just explains how we can do the uptake rate. We know how much of the performance reference compound we put in the passive sampling device at time equals zero, and we know how much is present after the deployment. So by knowing those two concentrations, we made up and the second we measure, we can know the elimination and allow us to get the uptake rate. If you go then to slide 41, the uptake rate, the concentrate, I've essentially made a little more complicated than it has to be because I've assumed that you don't know if you're in the linear uptake range. I've assumed that you don't know that. Once you spreadsheet this, it's not hard to run this calculation. but you know how much of the compound is present when you measure it. You know the volume of the passive sampling device, and you know KE, the uptake rate, because of the labeled compound. And so that way you can get the sampling rate. If you know the sampling rate and how long you had it out there, you can calculate, then that gives you the water concentration.
Thank you very much.
I had a question, Kim. This is Celia, Jen. you know, I guess with mercury, we spend a lot of time thinking about uptake from food, and you did mention before that, of course, this is not, that can't take into account food exposure. And I wondered for your compounds, do people have an idea of how important uptake from food is, and how big a problem that, or, you know, how big of a problem is that in terms of modeling without that component?
Well, what we saw was actually trying to look at, you know, if you look at bioaccumulation factors or bioconcentration factors, either one, and you look at a specific fish species, let's say. So if you looked at bass and you look at the, even probably for mercury, but certainly for the case for generally pesticides, the bioconcentration factors are all over the place. You know, they're oftentimes two and regrettably three orders of magnitude variability in the literature. So trying to guesstimate concentration in a bass from water concentration has been challenging, to say the least. What we've found, we have these paired actually with crayfish, and then we had them also, we also pulled fish in these in these areas. And what we hope to do is to get essentially a bioconcentration factor to look at relative to organisms that hopefully will be tighter than that wide range that we already see in the literature. So we pulled crappie, which are kind of lower on the food chain, and we pulled bass, which are a little bit higher on the food chain. And actually, it was kind of interesting because I was thinking, well, we're not capturing the food thing. But turns out the samplers matched more closely with the higher food chain organisms. And so I don't know if that's just because the difference between sites was greater for the higher trophic level organism. So we saw better, you know, larger difference. So I can't say, but it was kind of interesting that it matched up at least more closely with the higher trophic, which you would think would include a lot more food component.
Right.
But they're all tied together. I mean, you know, and that's where my, you know, I try to lean on my modelers, you know, because what they're eating is because there's more in the water. So if we, you know, so it's kind of this catch-22 egg and chicken thing, because they're, so I don't have a good answer, but I'm hopeful.
I wondered if there was any sort of biokinetic modeling, like, you know, like Nick Fisher does for metal for the pHs, and is there an estimate of?
Not for pHs.
Not for pHs.
It gets more complicated for pHs, of course, because invertebrates, you know, they're like about a factor of 100 less ability to metabolize pHs. Fish about a factor compared to humans. Fish about a factor of 10 less. So there, and of course, that's another complication with pHs and with using organisms in general, especially for organics. Probably less so for metals, but for organics, a lot of organisms can metabolize these. And then, of course, people want to chase looking at metabolites or biomarkers, and that makes a nightmare for a chemist.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, well, I would just like to, if you do have a question and you didn't get a chance to ask it, I just wanted to remind everyone that Dr. Anderson and Kim, Dr. Chen's email addresses are on the initial slide of the slide presentation. They're also listed on the SRP Risk Learning webpage. That's on, the link to that is on the addition, or will be when it's up again, when Kluin is up again, will be on the additional resources page. With that, I would like to thank our presenters, Dr. Kim Anderson and Dr. Celia Chen. I would also like to thank Patrick for running the call and getting us through the technical difficulties. And I'd like to thank everyone here for joining us today for the second session in this series on ecological risk, new tools and approaches. This Internet Web Seminar Series is a collaboration between Superfund Research Program and EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation of EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. This series will feature researchers from the SRP as well as collaborators from EPA, and will explore new approaches to understanding the risks that hazardous substances pose to wild populations and ecosystems. Our next seminar will be on August 19th, so please mark your calendars. And the next risky learnings, we'll explore it, and it'll explore the resistance to wild populations chronically exposed to PCBs and PAHs. It will feature SRP grantees Dr. Mark E. Hahn from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Dr. Rich DeGilio from Duke University. Details on this session will appear on the SRP Risk E-Learning webpage. The link is provided again in the additional resources webpage linked from the last slide on this presentation. The session will also be advertised in TechDirect newsletter. We hope you will join us on August 19th for the next session. And that concludes today's presentation. Thank you to everyone for your participation. Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you,
Bye.
Chuck
thank
and
you.
Patrick, Jean.